To properly appreciate the history of American theater, you have to study one of its titans. Playwright Tennessee Williams is maybe best known for his searing drama A Streetcar Named Desire, although I will spare you my interpretation of Stanley Kowalski bellowing Stella. But it was Williams' play The Glass Menagerie that brought him fame. From the time it premiered in New York in 1944, it has probably never been out of production. The play tells the story of Tom, a thinly veiled Tennessee, looking back at life with his mother Amanda and disabled sister Laura in St. Louis in the middle of the Great Depression as they struggled to escape their circumstances. Many critics see it as one of the quintessentially American dramas of the 20th century. Glass Menagerie returns to the stage in Milwaukee tonight for a run at In Tandem Theater. Veteran Milwaukee actress Angela Iannone will play Amanda. Mary McDonald Kerr directs, and Chris Fleer is In Tandem's artistic director. Fleer tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that this play was a watershed moment in American theater.
There's before GM and there's after GM.
Yep.
You know, I mean,
right.
It was really the knife that cut the century in half in terms of, of
and
style and everything.
Right.
Allowed an American voice in the room rather than all those Scandinavians.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
And sort of saying, well, this is our heritage. This is who we are. This is how we speak.
And mm-hmm. we have drama, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have something to say based upon our experiences past and present as Americans.
Yeah.
It certainly has giant universal themes, but it's also really about this time in his life and the demon and the and it was in response to what happened to his sister. I mean, that's why he wrote the play, was because it was a reaction to
right. And in real life,
Rose being lobotomized and
exactly.
the horrible guilt of having left.
And you mentioned Guernica and all of those things and you think about the sea change in all of the arts after the First World War, leading up to the Second World War, and going mm-hmm. – and of course, and he was in that cauldron mm-hmm. of, you know, along with everybody else, kind of, like you say, trying to respond to what the heck happened in the fields of France mm-hmm. and Belgium, and then what happened with the crash of the stock market. And, you know, and you're looking at the American promise literally to dust on the prairies, mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. know, and people
yeah.
starving
mm-hmm.
to death.
Mm-hmm.
In great numbers,
yeah.
and
yeah.
and he's responding to that as well.
Yeah. And,
yeah,
and Roosevelt doing the best he could, and doing really quite an amazing job, but really not quite enough until circumstances necessitated the creation of the military industrial complex, which kind of saved us and cursed us at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know?
Do you think Williams was responding to that too in this?
I think a little bit, because Williams certainly experienced that too, coming from his grandparents' home mm-hmm. in the South into that St. Louis atmosphere of warehouses and Salitex and fluorescent tubes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That moving away
from urbanization of yeah, mm-hmm. that culture.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and the,
a
you know,
manufactured existence and, mm-hmm. a, and a standardized existence.
I think that's important. Standardized.
Yeah. Yeah. The life at the factory of the day after day of this is what you have. This is the choice you have of to go to. I mean, and that's, you know, people say, well, why is this relevant today? And I'm like, a young man contemplating walking to a factory every day for the rest of his life, that's not a universal theme. That I mean, that's of the responsibility and the family ties. And I love that Tom is saying to Jim about what's happening in the world, and I have a need to be a part of it and to respond to it and to write about it and to – I need to be global. I need to be paying attention to everything. I feel like now that that's happening a lot here of people, that you have some young people screaming, why aren't we paying attention? There's so many horrible things happening, and what are we going to do about it? And a lot of other people are going, I can't think about that. I need to think about myself and my path and my mm-hmm. – I'm going to set up this nice, standard, expected life for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And
safe.
Safe.
Yeah.
And predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, yeah, above all, predictable.
Predictable.
Yeah.
Williams, I mean, a lot of people talk about his language, and I have always loved his language.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way it sort of soars mm. and swoops and is very delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And as an actor, Angela, do you find that?
Oh, it's lovely mouthfuls of these beautiful descriptive words. And setting it in that Southern dialect, it's a glorious place to go. That's part of the music of Americana. That's one of the big challenges as an actor, is get that Southern dialect so that you can do Williams. It really is delicious. That's an excellent descriptive There's an interesting thing that happens with William's scripts as well, because there are so many different versions of the same thing. Tennessee Williams' Stage Directions is a play in itself.
So what one are you using? Which edition?
We're using the acting edition by Dramatist Play Service.
Okay.
Yeah, which is a
– So do we know where that was in the lineup? Is like number two or three or
– Compared to some of the later published editions that were published for reading only, it's pretty sparse.
I think it's pretty early in response to the original production.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, in the original production – there were all kinds of crazy things happening with projections and subtitles and
oh, it's famous for that.
Scores.
I mean, that was one of it. Sort of broke out. Not only did it break out in terms of the type of play that it was, but the production changed the way you know that we do theater.
And then it employed the then state of the art of modern stage technology, with all this, you know, projections and gauzes,
stuff
and
that we take for granted now, you know.
Right.
But there's a in the Jane brought to me when we were early on going, okay, are we doing this stuff? And she had an edition that had a note from Tennessee saying, had I known how effective Ms. Taylor's Lorette, who had played Amanda, how had I known how effective her performance would be, I wouldn't have done all that. We don't need that anymore. So he himself said, don't need that stuff.
Right. You just need Lorette Taylor.
You just need Lorette Taylor.
Yes, small shoes to fill then.
Which I found so interesting that – because I just find it so interesting that she managed to – I think he thought – because he was writing his mother, I think he thought that no one would ever be able to
hit it.
And she just hit it and we went on from there. So because I was a little bit worried about how it had got cut because I had never seen anything with all that – those bells and whistles on it. And it was comforting to find out that he himself said.
That's true, that after a while.
Well, how do you approach Amanda and not make her a Gorgon? Because it's so difficult. He had such a tortured relationship, both positive and negative, with her. And it comes out in this play.
It's really interesting to me that these kinds of descriptives get used. When I announced that I was playing the role on Facebook, like you do, I got all kinds of little remarks popping up and people using descriptives like that that actually took me aback. Amanda is my third Williams diva, and I never found them to be horrible. I find them – those kinds of descriptives come up because people get like highlights from the texts, and then they get off on the wrong foot. It's really easy to say broken Southern belle. But what you actually get is a Carol Burnett script.
Right. That's exactly right.
Right? Somebody spoofing the absolute delicate magic of what happens with his female characters. And Amanda in particular is extremely careful with her children.
She's so smart. Her need is so big. Yeah. She's strapped this family on her back and survived the Depression with no resources.
Resources. Husband abandoned her. No true job skills and not afraid to work.
Not afraid. Yeah. She has jobs.
Not,
you know, she's not saying go save the family because I'm sitting home and being a Southern belle. She's got all these little demeaning, humiliating jobs.
She's doing everything she can in an economic environment that is utterly cruel to women.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the glass menagerie is not the glass, and Laura isn't the glass. It's the menagerie of these people in this cage and how they are their own saviors and their own destructive forces. And they can't survive with each other, and they can't survive without each other.
And they're all so fragile.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're all so desperate in their own needs that can never be fulfilled in this situation.
I think, too, there's an interesting thing that happens with William's women and in the way that we have observed and criticized and sort of put in an academic structure the way we look at his plays. The women that get these sort of pejorative adjectives are the women who are sexualized, however they talk about it. Maggie wants to have sex with Brick. Blanche is trying desperately to find someone who will cherish her not only emotionally but physically, reaching out, grasping onto the sailors who litter her lawn in the mornings. And Amanda is not a virgin. She was a married woman with an active courtship life that certainly included some sexual experimentation as it went in those days. We're not going to pretend all those Southern girls were sitting sipping lemonade all the time. And now she is completely without any sort of acknowledgement of herself as
a woman.
A woman.
As a desired creature.
A creature of desires.
Yes.
And
yes.
The husband that's gone, the picture that's being painted now is that it was a hot relationship.
Yes.
He came in and blew her doors off,
yeah.
And it was a
perhaps her doors.
She made decisions all based on the electricity between
right.
them.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at American drama and the way that the women are written, when we look at the big giants, Williams is the only one who allows any of his women any kind of sex life.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen in O'Neill. That doesn't happen in Miller. They're little meat props.
Yeah,
but and Laura's situation in the play, I feel like at this time, Amanda and Tom are finally at the point where they're really getting their eyes opened to the Laura problem. You know, that it's not something that they really were conscious of or allowed themselves to see or wasn't even visible all through her life. But now at this time in history, in her life, it's become very urgent.
Mm-hmm. In a way, I almost think of it as the moment that is the catalyst for everything else that happens, is that realization.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That's what causes the two of them. I mean, they've been kind of going along, you know, sparring, doing whatever their thing.
Well, right. But surviving, getting through high school, getting into young adulthood, surviving the depression. I got my thing, and I can see Amanda saying, I need to get him to adulthood. I'll get him raised.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do anything it takes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then Tom will be a man, and he'll go off, and Laura will get married, and I'll have made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tom's doing his part, kind of, but oh my God, he's not behaving in a way that's and it becomes clear Laura's just not going to get any farther. If anything, she's going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been one of the really interesting things is looking at Laura. You know, modern psychiatrists have looked at Rose's well-documented medical history, and she was diagnosed. Tennessee's sister Rose was diagnosed as a schizophrenic, but looking back at her records and everything that she went through and writing autobiographical information from Tennessee, she was most likely a very high-functioning autism and Asperger's. And looking at it through that filter as an actor and as a director has been so wonderful, instead of thinking of her as insane or
mm-hmm.
having an anxiety that's because that gets made fun of too. That
right.
that
right,
high, kind of. Tense, anxious Southern girl gets thrown on the spoof pile too.
Right. Right.
But that realization, you know, that after the second scene of the, okay, the Laura problem is sitting right here. What are we going to do?
Right.
What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The rest of the play happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yes, things are different for women now. It might not be the exact same problem, a mom looking after a disabled child and looking at the future. That's still, you know, they're going to do Good People at the Rep later this year. It's the same story.
Yeah.
I have a desperate woman.
Yes.
Trying to take care of her adult daughter.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
going, come on, I need a little help here.
Help me out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Help me out.
And what are the obligations? What are the obligations?
Yeah. Great plays have this thing that they possess, that they become a prism through which your own time is refracted. That's why Shakespeare wrote great plays. The few he wrote are emblematic of whatever time you happen to be doing them in. And
mm-hmm.
and especially Glass Menagerie is going to be, for at least I'm sure the next 100 years, unless everything comes crashing down with the economy. I have no idea. It will reflect and refract the time in which it's produced.
And as we were saying at the very beginning of this conversation, it is distinctly American.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that American voice. And I am so looking forward to seeing it. I want to thank you so much for coming in and having this great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Angela Iannone plays Amanda. Mary McDonald Kerr directs in Tandem Theater's production of The Glass Menagerie. Chris Fleer is in Tandem's artistic director. They spoke with Bonnie North. The play opens tonight at the company's theater in the basement of the 10th Street Church on Wisconsin Avenue. That's all for Lake Effect on this Friday, a week's worth of Lake Effects, in fact, produced by Dan Harmon and Bonnie North, along with yours truly. We get production assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Audrey Nowakowski, web support from Michelle Matternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Keep listening. Fresh air comes your way next. Next.